So Zerg and Perk Aleph Mishnah Daladin Full Perk Base Mishnah Gimel. Since the previous Mishnah talked about somebody who had been condemned to be killed by Beis Din and what his status is regarding a vow to give either his market value or his Erech to the Beis HaMikdash. The Erech is a fixed value based on what age group he fits into and his gender. This is a much more general value given by the Torah, as opposed to a more precise market value based on how much he would be sold as a slave in the marketplace. This Mishnah goes slightly sidetracked to discuss Ha'isha She'yotza Lehareg, a woman who had been condemned to be killed by Beis Din, but this woman happened to be pregnant, and the question is whether we view her fetus as being separate from her, such that we would not be able to kill her until she gives birth, so that we don't kill the fetus as well. So the Mishnah rules, we do not wait for her to give birth, since the fetus is considered to be a part of her own body. In general, there is a requirement upon the Beis Din to kill the person who they condemn to death on that very same day that they give their verdict. Otherwise, it causes great distress and pain for the one who is going to be killed the longer you drag it out. And that is why we do not wait for the fetus to be born, since anyway the fetus is considered to be a part of her own body, and the regular requirement to kill the person who has been convicted immediately on the same day would still apply. That having been said, Yoshua al-Hamashber, once she sits on the birthing stool, that's not necessarily meant literally, but the point is that she has started labor, and the process of this fetus coming out has already begun. Now we no longer view it as being a part of her body, and therefore, we must wait before killing her until she gives birth. Continues the Mishnah with another slightly related law. A woman who is killed by Beis Din, the law is that it is forbidden to benefit from a dead body. Now, the Mishnah seems to imply, if read simply, that it is permitted to benefit from her hair. However, the Gemara explains that this cannot be read literally because that's considered to be a part of her body and therefore it is forbidden to benefit from it. And so the Gemara explains that we're actually talking about a case where she had some sort of wig which she wore as hair. And even in that case, it would generally be forbidden because something which she wears is also forbidden together with the rest of her body. It's considered to be secondary to her body and would also be forbidden if for benefit. However, the Gemara explains that we're talking about a case where before she died, she stated that she wants to give this wig over to her daughter. That's the example of the Gemara, but the point is that she revealed her intention to remove the wig from herself. And at that point, it no longer is considered to be secondary and sort of a part of her body. And in this particular case, it would be permitted to benefit from that wig once she dies. And the Mishnah ends off, Behemosh Neregor, a animal which has been killed by Beis Din. There are certain cases where that is required. For example, if the animal killed somebody or was involved in a sin, for example, if a person lay down with the animal, it is learned from Pesukim that in this case, Asura B'Hanoya, it would be forbidden to benefit from that animal in the same way that it is forbidden to benefit from a dead human being. And this would include every last part of that animal, even the hair of the animal would be included in this prohibition of benefiting from it. Perek Beis Mishnah Aleph. The first part of this perek, the first half of the Mishnah really, talks about the laws of Erchin, these fixed values given by the Torah for designating one's value to the Beis HaMikdash. But because of the way that the Mishnah phrases a particular law, the entire perek is going to go sidetracked to discuss laws from all over the place, which have this similar structure, which we're going to see is going to be a minimum and a maximum. But for now, the Mishnah is sticking to the laws of Erchin, and although the Torah gives a fixed amount based on one's age and gender, the age and gender of the person who is the subject of the vow, one doesn't necessarily say that he's going to give his own Erech to the Beis HaMikdash. He could say, I'm going to give the Erech of somebody else to the Beis HaMikdash. And we would base the amount that he has to give on the subject of his vow. However, if when this person makes the vow, he is very poor and he can't actually afford, he doesn't own that amount of money to be able to give, the Torah gives allowance for a procedure where he can go to a kohen, who would make an evaluation of how much this person owns, and require him to give a smaller amount than that which is generally required by the Torah. And the Mishnah says, one can never give less than a seller, the value of a seller, to fulfill his erech vow. The pasuk says, "V'chol erkcho yeh b'shekel hakodesh," any erech vow of yours must be given with the holy shekel. A shekel in the Torah is equivalent to a seller in the Mishnah. And that pasuk is teaching that the minimum amount to be given is a seller. The Mishnah will elaborate on the ramification of this. V'leyosal chamishim seller. And a donation of somebody's erech is never going to be more than 50 seller. That is the amount which is fixed by the Torah for a man who is between the ages of 20 and 60. The erech of such a person is 50 seller, and that is the highest erech. Ketzad, how so? The Mishnah is now going to explain the minimum amount of a seller. If somebody is very poor and he makes an erech vow, and he only owns a seller. So nosan seller, he gave a seller in order to fulfill his erech vow, and then v'hesher, he later on became more wealthy, and he can now afford the full amount of the erech, says the Mishnah, in nosan klum. He would not need to give anything because he fulfilled his obligation by giving the seller. However, if he only had less than that, and he gave pochis miseller, he gave less than a seller, either because that's all he had, or because he decided to give a smaller amount at the beginning. Either way, he cannot fulfill his obligation by giving only that amount, and therefore the hesher, if he later on becomes more wealthy, and he now does have enough to fulfill the full amount of the erech, and the Mishnah is going to talk about a case where he obligated himself to give the erech of a man between the ages of 20 and 60. So once he gets that amount of money, nisan chamishim sela, he will be obligated to give 50 sela. Now Mishnah has a discussion about somebody, hoyob yodov chomish sloim, somebody had 5 sela, he owned 5 sela. So at this point, he was not able to give the full erech of 50 sela like he vowed. He goes to a kohen, and the kohen makes his evaluation, and he finds that he has 5 seller. That's what he's able to give. Rabbi Meir says, "Ein noisen el achas." He only needs to give 1 seller. When the Torah introduced this new idea of reducing the amount that he has to give to fulfill his erech vow, the Torah said that it's enough that he gives 1 seller, or in the Torah's language, 1 shekel, and that's enough. However, the chachomim say, "Noisen es kulam." He's obligated to give all that he has. Because all the Torah was doing is providing a minimum to which you are able to reduce the amount that he has to give. However, he needs to give all that he owns at that point. And now the Mishnah goes back to its original statement, "Ein bo agrochin pochas misela." To fulfill one's erech vow, he cannot give less than a sela, v'leyos al-chamishim sela. And there is never an erech vow which would require somebody to give more than 50 sela. And now the rest of the perek is going to discuss other totally unrelated laws, but which also have a similar structure, that there is a minimum and a maximum. Now, we're not going to go into all of the details of some of these rather complicated laws, but to give a small background to the first example, which the Mishnah Isaac is going to go to, and this regards the laws of a nidah, a woman who has a fixed time that she bleeds. When she does so, she becomes tomei, impure, as a nidah, and she has this status of being a nidah for the next 7 days, for a week, and it is forbidden for her to have relations with her husband during that period. Following that period of 7 days, there is a period of 11 days, during which she can become what is known as a zova. If she bleeds during any one of these 11 days, then she becomes known as a shemeres yom keneged yom, which means that she needs to make sure that she doesn't bleed anymore for the entire next day. Not that she needs to make sure, she needs to check whether she bleeds for the entire next day. And if she goes by the entire next day without bleeding, then as long as she also goes to the mikveh, she would be pure that evening. Now, if she sees, let's say, the next day, for 2 days in a row, she bleeds. Once again, she would have to check on the third day. On the third day, she would go to the mikveh, and if she does not bleed that entire day, then she would become tohar, she would become pure that evening. However, if for 3 days in a row she bleeds, then she becomes a zova, or a zova gedoyla, who is also a woman who is tomei for 7 days. And at the end of that 7-day period, she would once again go to the mikveh in order to purify herself, and she would have to bring korbanos, sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash, at the end of this period of 7 days of being a Zava. However, this is also only the case if she does not bleed during that 7-day period. She can only bring those korbanos and go to the mikveh to purify herself once she has a week without bleeding. Now, this Mishnah talks about a woman who lost count. She's unsure where exactly in her cycle she is holding, and she bleeds, and she's unsure whether this blood is the sign that she is a nidah. This is signifying the beginning of her week as being a nidah, or perhaps she's during her 11 days where bleeding would make her into a zava or a shmeres yom keneged yom. A woman would have to wait the next day and would be pure if she doesn't bleed again. If she does bleed 3 days in a row, she would be a zava and tomei for 7 days, but she's unsure where exactly in her cycle she is at. The question of the Mishnah is, how many days need to pass without her bleeding such that she can be totally sure that when she does next bleed, it will definitely signify the beginning of her nidor period? Remember, that is the bleeding which always is supposed to happen, the bleeding of any other day other than on the first day of her being a nidah is not necessarily a regular thing which occurs. So the question of the Mishnah is that a woman who no longer is aware of where exactly in her cycle she is at, how many days of not bleeding need to pass for her to know that when she next bleeds, it will definitely be the sign of the beginning of her nidah period. Ein Pesach batoya, regarding a woman who makes a mistake, she's no longer sure where in her cycle she is at, there's no restarting and knowing for sure that this is the beginning of the nidor period, poches mishiva, which is created by any less than 7 days of not bleeding, v'layose al shiva asar, and never more than 17 days of not bleeding are required. Since the normal cycle of a woman's bleeding is supposed to be 18 days, 7 days of a nidor, followed by 11 days where she can possibly become a shmeres yom keneged yom or a zava. So if she bleeds once and then 17 days pass and then she bleeds after that, since that bleeding is the usual guaranteed bleeding, she can be sure that indeed that is the sign of the beginning of her nidor period. Once the 11 days are over, then the next time she bleeds, she begins her nidor period. So in the worst case scenario, the last time that she did bleed was on the first day of her previous nidor period. Even if that's the case, but once 17 days have passed, now it's the 18th day, she can be sure that this is after the 11 days, and therefore it certainly does begin her nidor period. Now what happens if the woman bled twice, for 2 days running, or for 3 days running? One could have made the mistake to think that now she'll only need to wait 16 days of not bleeding, because in the worst case scenario, the 2 times that she did bleed were on the first and second day of her being a nidah. That means that 16 days later would already be after 18 days, and it would signify the beginning of her next nidah period. However, this is not the case, because it could be that the first out of those 2 days that she bled was actually the last of the 11 days. Which means that the second day that she bled was only the first day of her being a nidah, which means that once again she needs to wait 17 days. And the same would apply if she bled for 3 days running. It could be that the first 2 times were on the last 2 of the 11 days, and only the 3rd time was the first day of her being a nidah. Now, if she bled 4 times on 4 days running, now we would already start to reduce the number of days that she needs to wait. Because again, what's always the worst case scenario? That the last time that she bled was on the first day of her nidor period. In which case, only after waiting another 17 days and reaching the 18th day would you be able to be sure that this is the beginning of the next cycle of her being a nidor. But in a case where she saw, let's say, 4 days running, if indeed the 4th day, which was the last time she saw blood, was the first day of her being a nidor, that means that she saw blood for 3 days running during the 11 days. Now that makes her into a zava who becomes tomei for seven days, but that means that once she becomes a zava, the law is that she cannot begin her next nidor period until she goes 7 days without bleeding. And then in general, if she knew exactly what was going on, she would bring korbanos, go to the mikveh, but that's irrelevant when we're coming to decide when exactly she becomes a nidor. So the point is that if she indeed became a zava, as soon as she waits 7 days of not bleeding, and then the next time she bleeds, that would be the beginning of her nidor period. On the 4th day, when she bled, that was the day that possibly she was supposed to become a nidor. However, because she now has the status of a Zova, she does not begin her nidor period. But the second that she has 7 days of not bleeding, the next time she bleeds, that would be the beginning of her nidor period. So if she sees blood 4 days running, then we would say that she only needs to wait 7 days. But that's not true, because there's still an option that maybe the first 2 days were at the end of her 11 days. And she only saw, however, there were only 2 days within the 11 days, so she did not become a Zova. That would mean that the next 2 days were the first 2 days of her being a Nidor. But that would mean that she would not need to wait 17 days now, but only 16 days. Because this is always going to be the worst case scenario. In a case where she saw blood for 4 days running or for more days, if we assume that 3 of the days were during her 11 days, the last of the 11 days, that would already reduce the amount that she would have to wait to only 7 days. So the worst case scenario where she would have to wait the longest would be in a case where the first 2 days only of her bleeding were during the end of her 11 day period. And then the rest of the days that she was bleeding were already into her nidor period. So in a case where she saw blood 4 days running, that would mean that the last time she saw blood was on the second day of her nidor cycle, of her being a nidor, which means that if she waits 16 days now and then bleeds, that means that 18 days have passed, and she would know that this is indeed does signify the beginning of her next nidor period. And now this continues. If she bled for 5 days running, then in the worst case scenario, that would mean that the first 2 days were at the end of the 11 days. And the next 3 days were already into her nidor period, which means that she only needs to wait 15 days in order to be sure that the next time she bleeds signifies the beginning of her nidor period. And so on and so forth. But we see that now the numbers are diminishing. Now, according to this pattern, if she sees blood for 13 days in a row, it would come out that she would only need to wait 7 days of not bleeding in order to know that the next time she bleeds signifies the beginning of her nidor period. The Mishnah's next example of this minimum and maximum structure is regarding the laws of tzaras. Tzaras is certain spots which appear on the skin and come as a result of certain sins, and they would make one tome, impure. However, it's not enough that somebody has those spots on him to be impure, but it has to be that a kohen will declare him to be impure. Now, when he goes to be examined by the kohen, based on the features of this particular person's tzara'as, the kohen will either declare him to be impure on the spot, or he will tell him to go and be totally alone for a week, and then to return. And sometimes, after that, based on what has happened to the spot, the kohen might declare him to be impure, or pure, or he might tell him to go back again, to be alone, and then come back a week later. Now, as well as tzaras appearing on one's skin, it can also appear on his clothes, or on his house. The Mishnah says, Eman goyim pachas mishavua echad, there is never less than a week that somebody would be sent away to be alone, and then to return to the kohen. Meaning in a case where the kohen doesn't give a decision on the spot, the minimum time that he would be sent to be alone is for 1 week. V'lo yoser al shlosha shavuos, and never more than 3 weeks. It could be there's a particular case regarding tzaras which appears on one's house, that the kohen could send him back for up to 3 times to be alone for a week, and then to return for him to be able to examine it again and declare him to be impure or not. Or to declare the house or the clothes to be impure. The case of 3 weeks happens to be specifically regarding the tzaras on a house. Mishnah Beis, the cycle of the moon going around the earth takes roughly 29 and a half days. However, it's slightly more than that. And because of that, the Jewish months which follow the cycle of the moon, each month is either made up of 29 days or 30 days. However, it's not enough that every other month is going to be 29 days and every other month is going to be 30 days. Because the length of a month, the length of the cycle of the moon is not exactly 29 and a half months, it's slightly more than that. Due to that, as well as to certain rules with regards to fixing the dates in the calendar, in Pirchsim Arbor Chodoshim Amorboim Bashona, a year can never have less than 4 months, which are full months of 30 days, V'leinira Yosel Shmoina, and it doesn't appear to be right and logical to the Chachomim to ever add more than 8, to ever make more than 8 months full. So on average it would be 6 and 6, but sometimes there could be up to 8 months which would be, have 30 days or 29 days, depending on the year and how the dates fall out. The Shteh Lechem were two loaves of bread which were brought as a korban on Shavuos, and these loaves were baked always the day before Shavuos, and then they were offered and given out to the Kohanim on Shavuos itself. So Shteh Lechem Necholos Ein Pochis Mishnayim, the Shteh Lechem, these two loaves of bread, would never be eaten before the second day after they were baked, meaning the day after they were baked, V'layos Al Shalosh, are later than the third day, which is 2 days after they were baked. That would be in a case where the day before Shavuos was a Shabbos, and therefore the loaves could not be baked on Shabbos itself. So they would need to be baked 2 days before Shavuos began. Lechem Aponim, the 12 loaves of bread which were placed on the Shulchan in the Beis HaMikdash each week on Shabbos, and they were there for the entire week, and the following Shabbos they were eaten by the Kohanim. They were given out and eaten by the Kohanim. These also were baked always on the Friday, the day before they were placed on the Shulchan, such that Lechem Aponim Ne'echol in Parchis Mitisha. The Lechem Aponim were never eaten before the ninth day after they were baked. They were baked usually on a Friday and eaten the following Shabbos, an entire week later. They were never eaten later than on the 11th day after they were baked. That would be in the case of a 2-day Rosh Hashanah, which fell on a Thursday and a Friday. In that case, the bread would need to be baked on the Wednesday and only be eaten 2 Shabbosim later, which would be the 11th day after they were baked. Kotan Nimoil, a baby receives a bris milah in Pochis Mishmaina, never before its 8th day, V'loyos al Shneimasar, and never after the 12th day of the baby's life. We're talking about a fully healthy baby boy. But if it was born during Ben HaShemoshos, which is the twilight time of day, where it is considered to be a halachic doubt whether it's part of the night or the daytime, and therefore it is unsure whether that baby, on what day the baby boy was born. The day really starts from the nighttime already. And although the law is that if the baby's 8th day falls on a Shabbos, it is permitted to perform the Bris Milah on Shabbos. If it's not the 8th day itself, then it's forbidden to perform the Bris Milah on Shabbos. Now, in the case where we have a doubt as to when exactly the baby was born, we would never know for certain when its 8th day was, so we would not be able to perform that Bris Milah on a Shabbos. So if the Shabbos was the day when the baby was possibly its 8th day, possibly its 9th day, they would wait until the Sunday, which was possibly either the 9th or the 10th day. Now, if Sunday and Monday were 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, or a 2-day Yom Tov, then in such case they would only be able to perform a Bris Milah on the Tuesday, which is already the 12th day of that baby's life. Mishnah Gimel, in person may ask for Tkiyah HaMikdash, there were never less than 29 shofar blasts in the Beis HaMikdash on any particular given day. There would never be more than 48. This refers to Shabbos Chol HaMoed on Sukkos, when there were many extra korbanos and extra procedures done in the Beis HaMikdash, which would be accompanied by the shofar blasts. Now the Mishnah talks about the musical instruments which were used when the Levim would sing in the Beis HaMikdash. In Perchim Mishnei Nevolim, there would never be less than 2 musical instruments called a navel, which is translated to be a lyre, V'loimei Sifnel Shisha, and they would never have more than 6 of them, and this is purely for musical reasons, that it would be the nicest sound when there would be that number of these instruments. In Perchim Mishnei Chalilim, there would never be less than 2 flutes, and there would never be more than 12 flutes. They made this be the limit to correspond to the number of days during the year when the flute was played, as the Mishnah immediately goes on to elaborate. On 12 occasions during the year, the flute would be played in front of the Mizbeach, and these are the 12 times during the year when the full Hallel was said. When the Levim would sing the full Hallel, then they would add this flute to accompany it. B'shchidas Pesach Rishon, at the time that they were slaughtering the Korban Pesach, the main first Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan, B'shchidas Pesach Sheni, and when they were slaughtering the Pesach Sheni, which is brought a month later by those who are not able to bring the Korban Pesach on Pesach itself. They would recite Hallel whilst they were slaughtering and going through the process of bringing the Korban Pesach. Okay, of Yom Tov Rishon Shel Pesach, on the first day of Pesach itself, of Yom Tov Shel Atzeres, on the Yom Tov of Shavuos, of Shmenis Me'achog, and on the 8 days of Sukkos, when they would recite the full Hallel. V'lo yohem akim ba'av shel mecheshes, elam ba'av shel koneh. They wouldn't play a copper flute, rather a flute made of a reed, because its sound was sweeter. And when they reached the end of the instrument's playing, they would only end this song with a single flute instead of having all of the flutes stopping at the same time, because that is a nicer, more pleasant and beautiful way to end the song when there is just one flute at the end.